in our home, especially because we have as many children as we do, we really try to be as intentional as we can about finding some individual time with our kids. And one of the things we've been doing for a couple of years now is we've been telling our children that when they turn 10 years old, sort of as a rite of passage in some ways, if they're one of our boys, then they get a little trip with dad. And if they're one of our girls, they get a little trip with mom. So they can kind of pick their trips. And, you know, we don't take them to Europe or anything, but something that's somewhat doable and we can do within here. So my son turned 10 years old just a few weeks ago, and he has always wanted to go snorkeling. And so he said, Dad, I'd love to go snorkeling. And since the Keys are right south of us and some of the best snorkeling in the world is over there, I decided to jump in the car and take him down for 2 days to Key West to go snorkeling. So we drove down there. And we spent the last 2 days just me and Cullen snorkeling. My wife stayed home with the other 7 children. She needs several months of recovery from that, but she's doing okay. We went down. It was just a great time to just be with my son, to speak into his life, to have lots of hours in the car, individual time, just to kind of think through over the last few years, what are those foundational things that I want to make sure he's beginning to grasp and understand? And at 10 years old, as he enters into the next 10 years of his life, a new stage, just what that looks like and what I'm calling him into and what I'm encouraging him to be. And just thinking through all of what I wanted to capture on this little trip that we had for these 2 little days. And on my way back, we drove yesterday 8 hours back. We got home at 4:30. I had to preach here at 6, so had to leave at 5. I was home for 30 minutes. And in those 30 minutes, the entire world unfolded before me of how incredibly unthinkable the task is to try to instill into all of these children the realities that matter. We only have so much time to pour into our kids. And then at a certain point, they sort of emerge into the big world where we can't guard their hearts anymore and we can't walk them through every situation. And you kind of hope that you put enough in so that when they head out, that they're ready to face a world that doesn't give a rip about their protection or give a rip about them. And so to prepare them for that, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. And so I started thinking about what it might be like when one of my kids turns 18 or 19 and they head off on their big first see you later. And what am I going to tell them in that moment, right? Some of you have walked this. What do you say? You want to kind of wrap up as much as you can everything that you've tried to instill in them for all the years you've had them. And it dawned on me what it must have been like for Jesus in these moments that we are going to experience him now. Because we're about to walk into the very last supper that he is going to have with the guys that he has spent 3 years intentionally preparing for the incredible things that are going to come. And in this one last supper, this one last moment that he has with them, what is he going to do? What is he going to say? What is going to unfold? Because you've got to know deep down in your soul that if this is indeed the Messiah, the God and creator of the universe who came down and he has come to this moment, sitting in this place, some of the most extraordinary things we are probably going to hear are going to happen right here in this little supper. And we get to sit like a fly on the wall and listen into every word and watch every act that Jesus is going to effect. And I want to tell you, if we've learned nothing following Jesus up to now through the Gospels, we have learned this, that he does nothing without intention, nothing without specific calculated process, because there is nothing missed by Jesus. And so you know, every move he makes, every word he says, especially in a supper like this, the Last Supper, where he's going to give the speech and wrap into a neat bow everything that he has affected, we're going to find some crazy cool stuff here, right? And so we walk into this supper knowing that Jesus is going to unfold what he's taught. But Jesus is doing more than that in this supper. Remember, the task Jesus has in this supper, the task Jesus has with his disciples now, expands beyond the 3 years that he's been teaching the disciples. It expands throughout his entire life, and then it expands throughout the entire reality of human history. Because the story Jesus has come to fulfill, come to complete, come to bring clarity to, is the story that God has been unfolding from the very beginning of human history. And so we are going to watch Jesus in one supper bring together all of the critical foundational issues that we need to understand to bring clarity to us about the entire story of human history. If you've been with us at Mosaic for any given period of time, or you've been podcasting, you know we've been traveling from Genesis all the way through for the last 6 or 7 years, and we've been traveling through the story of human history and God's interaction in that. And so we started with creation, and we stepped into the fall. We watched as the consequences of the fall was going to destruct humanity, and God rescued us from ourselves in the flood, and then he preserves us in the Tower of Babel as he breaks us into nations so that in our unity we don't self-destruct. And then he chooses a nation and he brings them into their fullness under the reality of Egypt, a great nation, and then as they become slaves there, he brings them out of Egypt, and we see the perfect picture of a redemptive reality unfolding in the moving out of Egypt into the wilderness and into the promised land. The Passover meal is established during that time as God demonstrates the wonder of redemption there. They go into the promised land. We followed them in there. We followed them as they experienced the reality of God's protection through the judges or the redeemers, depending on how you translate that. We watched them decide that they want kings and ask for kings, and we watched what happens when humanity rules itself and puts God on the side, and watched God's protection despite that. We watched the prophets enter in and start speaking of this idea that all of this, the law that was established through Moses, the sacrificial system that was put in place, all of it was established as a foundational reality that we might not understand then, but that in good time Jesus will bring to clarity for us. And it was all part of demonstrating the reality of full redemption that God was going to bring to us as humanity. And then that unfolded into the 400 years of silence, and then the birth of Jesus Christ in the miraculous wonder of both the silence of that birth and the extraordinary miraculous loudness of that birth simultaneously. And then we watched Jesus grow. We met him at 12 years old, an extraordinary child, and we knew then something was coming. And then we watched Jesus emerge at 30. He was baptized in miraculous means. He went into temptation, fulfilling all sorts of things there. He went then up to Nazareth and declared himself Messiah. When he read the book of Isaiah in the synagogue, he went to Capernaum and started living out a powerful and extraordinary life of miracles. He started healing. He started bringing about forgiveness. He started speaking incredible things and teaching incredible things. He produced miracles. He's the one that's walked on water. He's the one that's the storms. We watched him do some of the most extraordinary things in all of human history, and all the while wondering what is going on. And then we sat, remember? We sat on the side of the mount and heard him teaching the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount. We spent months there lingering with him as we realized that Jesus was unpacking a brand new life. Not just a new portion to an old life, but he was showing us a brand new reality, a brand new way to live. He was describing a kingdom that he was from and what it was like to live for that kingdom, in that kingdom, to be part of that kingdom, the dominion of light and life instead of the dominion of darkness and death. And we felt this calling into something greater than we could have imagined. And then we watched Jesus travel the road as he was teaching his disciples all the way to Jerusalem. We found ourselves in Jerusalem with him, and now here we sit and we enter into the very Last Supper, and we get to go, what is he going to do here? Because this very night he will be arrested, he will be taken into trial, humiliated, broken down, torn to shreds, and then he will be taken to the cross. And all of that is about to happen, and this is the last moments. So let's go and see what Jesus does. Grab your Bibles, turn to the book of John. The Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, are like a 3D picture of the life of Jesus. When you read them simultaneously, they bring all the wonder and beauty of the whole together. You should always see them as a single unit. And so we jump around from gospel to gospel because it each brings more fullness to the wonder of the story of Jesus. And John chapter 13 here launches us into the meal on page 770 of our Bibles, which are under the seats if you don't have a Bible of your own here. Feel free to grab one of ours and keep it if you'd like. We'd love for you to have it if you don't have a good Bible at home. John chapter 13, verse 1. Listen, it starts so simply and yet so profoundly. Listen. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, just right there, stop for a second. Right off the bat, John reminds us that Jesus knows exactly what he's getting into, that he is not, was not, will never be a victim of humanity's violence or humanity's desire to kill God. Jesus walked into this with full reality and knowledge and allowed this to happen. He was a chooser of his death, not a victim of his death. Watch this. And then it says this: departing out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. We just got to stop and linger there for a second, because everything we're about to discover in this supper kind of comes back to this moment. One of the things we should anticipate that Jesus is going to demonstrate to us in this Last Supper is that he is faithful to love us to the end of ourselves, to the end of everything. There is nothing that he will not do to demonstrate his love to us. And this meal, in part, is going to be a new demonstration of the extent of his love, of who he is, of why he came, of what he's going to do, of the words that are going to be captured in his reality, words like healing, forgiveness, fulfillment, clarity, wonder, power, all these things, life, light, all these words, we're going to begin to see them again over and over and over again in this last few moments of Jesus's life. And then in all of that, he is going to remind us that because he loved us so much, because he gave himself for us, we are now free. And in that freedom, there are implications to that. There is a real reason in our freedom to now live out that freedom. So watch, let's see how that unfolds. Now, John starts this way in verse 2. During supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going back to God. I mean, do you hear this? This is that kind of language you catch in a movie when the movie's building toward a big moment, you know? And it's like the music gets louder and louder and louder, and you're like, it's coming! And you're waiting for the massive fine finality of the movie. And that's what you feel here. John's like describing it. And then Jesus, who knew that all things were his and knew that he was from God and he was returning to God and he was God. What does he do? What does he do? Tell me! Rose from supper. Rose from supper. That's where John takes us. I'm like, John, seriously, you've got to learn, bro. You can't do that to me. Jesus, the great and mighty, stood up. That's exactly, rose from supper. So you have to sit back for a second and go, okay, I got you. He rose from supper. I was expecting explosions, fireworks, big things. Rose from supper, and it says this. He laid aside his outer garments, and taking a towel, tied it around his waist. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with a towel that was wrapped around him. Seems simple enough, doesn't it? I mean, it's just not what you expect, is it? At least it's not what I expected. I mean, I'm expecting a speech to burst forth in flame from his mouth, and he picks up a basin and starts washing the disciples' feet. Now, many of us who have had any contact with the church at any given point kind of remember this story, right? I mean, Jesus washes the disciples' feet so that he could teach us to wash each other's feet, and that's so neat. But listen, you have no idea how incredibly shocking this moment is in this particular context. In fact, it is more than appropriate that John was building this up the way he did. He's kind of reminding the Jewish reader who might be reading this, this is still the God of the universe, just in case when you see him get down and wash his feet, you faint. Because if you were listening to the story and you were Jewish and it said, and Jesus got down and washed the disciples' feet, you might faint in the crowd. Because it is that absolutely unthinkable what Jesus might be doing here. Let me explain to you why this is the case. In Jewish times, and especially in this time, the washing of the feet was a really, really big deal, and it was deeply tied to all of culture and all of the social structure that existed in this world, both in the Jewish world and also in the Greek and Roman worlds, okay? So what would typically happen is this. If you were on a journey, of course, most people traveled by foot, some, of course, on horses and in, the carts and stuff like that, but for the most part, the common man, you and I, would just travel by foot. And so as you travel by foot, you're on dusty roads, even though you are hygienic and you keep yourself clean from the knees down, it just gets filthy. You're wearing sandals because it's warm in this region of the world. And so constantly you're stepping and stuff. You're walking at night a lot. You're walking in darkness. There's animals everywhere. They are constantly pooping everywhere. And so you're stepping in all of their droppings and you're stepping in mud and it's raining. And so you get the picture, right? I mean, we're not talking about American feet here, right? We are talking about the rest of the planet. And so when you get to somebody's house, it was very common for you, as you entered into the home, before you walked into the home and sat down for supper, there would be a basin provided for you with a towel. And you would put your feet in the basin, remove the sandals, you would wash your feet, really as an act of just decency before you entered the home, as well as it was the way that the host of the home said to you, you are welcome here. In fact, if you did not provide a bowl of water to someone entering your home, it was considered a deeply insulting act. It was your way of saying, don't enter my house. We see this happen in Jesus' life on occasion where there's no water provided, and it actually says in the Bible, not a good idea. It's them saying, I'm letting you in here, but you're not welcome. So this was tied to social etiquette. It was tied to everything. You would come in, you would wash your feet, and then you would enter into the home. Now, if you were invited to a party and someone invited you to their home, then there was a greater expectation. You didn't just show up and wash your own feet. They would provide a servant or one of their slaves to wash your feet. But here's the crazy part, right? The Jewish people, when they provided a servant to wash your feet, it had to be a Gentile servant. They would not even take one of their Jewish servants and use them to wash their guests' feet, because this was seen as an act so humiliating and so unclean that you would not put a servant of yours who was Jewish in the position to have to deal with that horrible thing. So you would choose a Gentile because, you know, they were unclean already, and so this really didn't matter. I get the thinking is weird, but you understand how deeply they viewed the washing of the feet thing as a unclean and not nice thing to do. And it was only for the lowest Gentile servant in the house to ever do it, ever. If you came to a meal like this one, where the boys are getting together for the Last Supper, they've rented a room. The room would have been provided with a basin and some water. And the expectation there would have been one of two things. Either of the 12, the one who was the runt in the family, he would prepare the water. He wouldn't be expected to wash the other's feet because he's not a servant, but he would just prepare the water for them, and then they would all wash their own feet. Or you might, on occasion, because you're family, right? You might just skip the whole thing. I mean, we're all family here. We don't really have time to sit down. So at this meal, what's happened is everyone has entered in and they've reclined at the table and they have not yet washed their feet, right? Because the basin does not have any water in it. So clearly, there's a little subtlety here saying not one of the 12 wanted to prepare the water. Why do you think? Because whoever prepared the water, they would be saying something about themselves. I am the runt of the family. This is my job. It's a bummer, but it's what I do. So they all sat down and they all waited to see who might prepare the water. You can imagine when Jesus stood up, took his outer garment off, and started pouring the water, you can imagine the thoughts that must have run through the disciples' minds. I know one that would have run through mine. Oh, bummer. This is a lesson about how bad I am. Because now Jesus, I'm waiting for the speech. Really? Really? You waited for me to get up and do this? I mean, come on. Put the water down, sit down, go wash your feet. That's what I would wait for. But Jesus gets up and he takes the water and he begins to wash the disciples' feet. It's one of those moments where you're sitting there and as Jesus takes your feet and he begins to wash them, you just don't know what to do. Have you ever been in those awkward moments where you know what's happening is all wrong, but you don't really know what to say about it, and so you just sort of stare into the distance and pretend it's not happening? That's what I think the disciples are going through. It's just like, looking at each other like, do we say something? Oh, of course we do. And if we do, it's got to be Peter. It's got to be Peter. Verse 6, he came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? Do you hear the indignation in this sentence, the horror? Like, you are coming to, no, this does not happen in my house. I mean, I want to look at Peter on occasion and say, how many times do you have to correct God before you get it? Every time you open your mouth and correct God, you always find yourself on the other end of bad, don't you? I mean, really? Haven't you learned? You are not washing my feet. Look at this. Jesus answered him, "What I am doing, you do not understand now, but afterwards you will understand." There it is. There is the magic moment, the key sentence. Do you see, Jesus is doing something here, and he says to us all, he says to his disciples, listen now. Peter, what I'm doing right now, it may seem to you many things. You may have 1,000 thoughts running through your head, and you may even be thinking, don't touch my feet, but listen to me, Peter. What I am doing right now, you will not fully understand now, but in time, when it's all done, you will see what just happened here. Jesus is cluing us into the fact that we should look back at this moment after the whole story's done, and we should come back here and go, what was he trying to show us? And you see, since we have the luxury of being on the other side of history, we get to look back and we get to see and we realize on the cross when Jesus was dying and we could not see what was happening in the invisible realms, we could not see what was happening in the spiritual realms, when his full act of redemption and cleansing was taking place in his death and all we got to see was him dying, now it all becomes clear. Now he fulfills it. He says, what I am doing is I am cleaning you up through becoming nothing, through becoming the least, the most horrible. Remember in Philippians, it actually says these words, he submitted himself even unto death on a cross for our sake. He became less than nothing. You know what's lower than the Gentile servant who washes feet? The thief on the cross. And Jesus became even that. And here he says to Peter, Peter, someday you will look back at this moment and you will know that the very first act at the Last Supper that I had with you was to remind you that I am here for a single idea, to make you clean, to make you clean, to wash you, to redeem you. Because if we do not understand that we are redeemed by the work of Christ, then everything else we will try to do in this life will fail us eventually. We must live out of our rescue. We must live out of our redemption, because our freedom is in our redemption and our life is lived out of that freedom. So Jesus starts right off the bat and says, I'm here to set you free. You'd think Peter gets it. But hey, Peter's just like us. It takes him a while. So he says this. Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet. I want to just climb off the wall as that fly and go, Pete, time to wake up, buddy. Jesus just corrected you. Now you're correcting him again? I mean, he literally sat down. You're going to wash my feet, Pete, what I'm doing. You may not understand now, but it has deep purpose. Trust me. You ain't washing my feet, man. No way. I'll wash yours. I mean, at this point, Jesus just goes, fine. You know what? Fine. Let me explain to you how this plays out. And I love this. In this beautiful conversation, Jesus said to him, right up there. Peter said to me, shall never wash my feet. Jesus answered him, if I do not wash you, you have no share with me. See, this is intentional too. You have to remember, when you're watching Jesus do stuff, even the things people are doing seemingly by accident around him are all part of an unfolding conversation that we all need to hear. And Jesus says, Peter, if I don't wash you clean, then you are not clean and you do not belong to me. So redemption is now not just a luxury. You understand what Jesus is doing here? I have come to redeem, but this is not a luxury. If you do not have me as redeemer, you are not clean, and therefore you live a life outside of the freedom of redemption. That's a big statement to make by anyone. Now, I love Peter, because Peter always seems at the very end to kind of go, oh, well, then, and look, Simon Peter said to him, Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head. I love that. It's like Jesus says, if I don't wash your feet, bro, you don't belong to me. Oh, the washing makes me belong to you. Here, do the whole thing. I want in. And let me just, on a side note, a little parenthesis on this entire message, let me just throw this out to you as a little encouragement, a little exhortation maybe, a little challenge. When we're following Jesus and you're chasing after him, you should have those moments in life where when you discover a little bit more about what it means to be part of his story, you just want in. And if those moments never come around, then chase harder after him. Because that's what happens when you really begin to follow Jesus, is you discover as he takes more from you, as you lose more of your life, you actually discover more freedom than you've ever had. And then you want more. And then you get yourselves into missional living, and it gets really insane. And you wonder what you've done. And then afterwards you wake up and go, this is what life looks like when you follow Jesus. Wash it all. Wash it all! And then Jesus basically, in a nutshell, says to him, Peter, I'm trying to illustrate something. Would you please keep quiet? You are blowing the entire deal here. Listen, I'm not going to cleanse the whole of you. I'm just doing the feet because you're already, and he unpacks this little clean thing, which we don't have time to unpack today. It's wondrous what he says in there, but he basically says to Peter, listen, I've got this covered. Just chill, okay? Let me just wash the feet. Can we just get on with it? And he washes the feet, and after he's done that, it says this, when he had washed their feet, verse 12, and put on his outer garments, he resumed his place. He said to them, do you understand what I have done? So he simply says, look, I have just gone around and I have just washed your feet, and I want now to bring full clarity to what I've done. The first thing we recognize about this is that Jesus is showing us once again that he is indeed our redemption. He is the answer to life and to light. Spurgeon, one of the greatest preachers of all time, perhaps, he wrote this about this particular passage. I love the way he put it. This act of tender, considerate affection performed under such circumstances. What are the circumstances here? Jesus is about to be arrested, betrayed, beaten, humiliated, crucified, and die. That's going to all happen in the next 24 hours. Under that circumstance, I don't think you'd be taking the time to hang out and wash the feet of the guys around you. Oh, but Jesus, he does. Performed under such circumstances to men who acted toward him in such ungenerous style. You know what the disciples are doing at this very meal? It happens in the meal. They're arguing about who's going to sit at his right hand still. It's still happening, yes. At this meal, they're vying for position to see who is going to be the greatest among them. They are trying to figure out what they are going to get out of the story of Jesus. These are people that do not see the full extent of all that he is doing for them. And we call that ungrateful. And guess who else is ungrateful? I know, me. That's right, I am. As are you, because we do not grasp the full extent of what God has done for us. So we seek him to give us what we think we need, when in fact he has already given us everything we will ever want. To men who acted toward him in such ungenerous style, proves to us that his love will bear the strain of our ill behavior, our lack of fidelity, and our 1,000 grievous failures. Having loved his own, which are in the world, he loved them to the end. To the end. And then Jesus, and only then, only when we fully grasp what he's doing for us in this beautiful symbol of what's about to happen on the cross, does he then say in verse 13, you call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. I have given you an example that you should do just as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor a messenger greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. See what Jesus is saying? Remember, He's showing us a picture of what he's about to do on the cross. So this isn't about the washing of feet. This is about something far bigger. He is saying, when I have completed the work that I'm going to do to set you free from a life of death and sin and horror, when you experience fully redemption and you wake up one day in me, free from yourself, free from your failures, free from everything, when you consider what I have done for you, it should then in that freedom be a no-brainer for you to use that freedom to love one another. He actually says it in the book of Galatians through Paul later on. You therefore, brother, do not use your freedom to indulge the sinful nature, but instead love one another with everlasting love. This is the idea by which we live our lives out of the freedom that we've already been given. In verse 18, he says this, I am not speaking of all of you. I know whom I have chosen, but the scripture will be fulfilled. He who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. I am telling you this now because it takes before it takes place, that when it does take place, you may believe that I am he. Jesus here takes a quick moment and says, guys, I just want you to know something. As I'm unpacking what I'm about to do in my redemption, sitting at our very table is the enemy. He's sitting right here. One of you among us will betray me. And I'm telling you this beforehand so that when it actually happens, you go, wow, he knew. He could have done something about it, but he knew. As a matter of fact, the very next part of this passage, you know what he does? Peter says, who is it? And Jesus says, I'm going to dip my bread in here and I'm going to hand it to the person who's going to betray me. Awkward moment. And he dips his bread and he hands it to Judas. And it says, Satan actually came and filled Judas right before that, in that moment. And so now you have the enemy himself sitting in the room with Jesus. Jesus hands Judas the bread, and this is what he says to him. You can read it right there. He says, now you ought to go quickly and go do what you need to do. Think about this for a second. Are you ready for this? Jesus is sending the one who is about to betray him that night off to go prepare quickly to betray him well. It's practically insane. I mean, killing him, there's an idea. Making him turn into dust, there's an idea. Sending him off into some dark hole somewhere, there's an idea. These are the ideas I would have. Jesus sends him off and says, go do the work you're going to do quickly, because this story is going to unfold exactly the way it needs to. I will become nothing for you. And so Jesus says to us the same way, listen, I'm going to take care of all of this for you. And here's what I want you to do. It culminates in verse 34. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another just as I have loved you. You also ought to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Wow. There it is. There it finally comes together. Once I've finished my work for your redemption, and once I begin the work in you that I'm going to bring to completion, here's what I want you to do in light of your recognition of the great rescue that I've effected for you. I want you to love each other. Love each other. You know why? Because when you do, people will say this, you must be followers of Jesus. They will know us by our love for one another. So it must start in our homes, right? I mean, if we say we follow Jesus, then in our homes it must start. As hard as our homes may be, as hard as our relationship with our parents may be at times, or with our children may be, as hard as our marriages may be, as hard as our internal relational craziness in our home may be, what are we called to? Because we are free to love one another, because they will know that we follow Jesus by what they see there. And then it filters right into here. As that unfolds into here, we ought to love one another, because they will know us by our love for one another, not by our doctrine or our deep, wondrous words or our incredible programs or our wonderful dress. They will know us by our love for one another. This is a big deal. This is a big deal. And we're called into this. And you know what he does very next in this little story? Peter says to him, I'm in. I'll go wherever you go. And Jesus goes, no, you can't go where I'm going. And Peter goes, yes, I will. And Jesus says, you're going to deny me three times. And Peter goes, and over my dead body. Okay. Thankfully, it didn't happen over his dead body. But Peter, in this moment, experiences Jesus telling him, you're going to deny me three times. And last week, if you remember, we talked about God's redemptive reality in Peter's failure. See what God's doing here? This is what he's saying. Listen carefully. I have done enough to cover anything that might stop you from being able to love one another. The enemy is in your midst. I get it. That's not an excuse. Love one another. You will fail and you will not succeed and you will feel like you can't. It's not an excuse. Love one another because my redemption has covered all of that. You can. You can. You must just fix your eyes on what he has already done for you. Spurgeon wrote a quote about this too, and I love this quote. And he speaks to us in the context of the foot washing, and he says this, on earth, the church will never be so clean that it will have no need of foot washing. I love that. Welcome to church. It's not a great place all the time. The church will never be able to stop with the purifying service until the Lord shall come. We should never stop working in one another's lives toward guiding each other into greater intimacy with Jesus. You, my brother and sister, may never expect or should never expect to join a church where there will be nothing for you to do. Whew, is this in America? Odd. Do not even desire such a position of idleness. I love that. Listen now. We shall never get among a community so pure that we shall see no faults in our brethren, and never shall we ourselves be so good that they will see no faults in us. Therefore, let us render and receive a happy mutual service in the church by which the sanctification of one and all will be promoted. In those words, Jesus said, if I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. We want to change the world, don't we? I mean, I certainly do. I want to make sure that we're the kind of church that lives on mission in our workplaces, in our communities, and around our globe, making real change with real people, demonstrating real redemption to them in the things we do and the way we spend ourselves. But I want to caution us all. We cannot sustain that kind of living or do that with any real long-term effect unless we first learn to love each other the way he has loved us. It matters that we love each other, not for the sake of the church, this organization to function, but for the sake of us being great gospel carriers. We have in our heads so often that we tithe because the church needs money and we've got to provide, or we serve because the church needs help and we've got to do something about that. We couldn't be more grossly misinformed. We tithe to protect our own hearts and guard our own hearts from being possessed by our possessions. And we serve because we love Jesus and we carry the gospel. What the church benefits from that is just the residual result of redemptive reality in our lives. We carry the gospel. That's why we do this. So, Jesus' love is enough for everything. It's enough for you and enough for me. And he calls us in that freedom to be enough for somebody else now by serving them.